order. It's 2:30. My apologies to anyone in the room and online. Our session went over, and we had another meeting that went over prior to this one. So sorry about that. It's that time of the year. We have three items on the agenda. I intend to get to all three. If we have to go over a little bit, I hope some members can accommodate that. We're going to do House Bill 136, House Bill 116, and House Bill 94. We'll take up first House Bill 136, and present for the record, we have Representatives Gruenberg, Guerra, Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. And just a reminder to members that our next meeting will be at 8 a.m. Wednesday morning to accommodate folks who are heading out for Easter break. So without further ado, Ms. Noriega.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. For the record, I am Heather Noriega, staff to Representative Rothberg, and the representative sends his apologies for not being here himself today. Before you have House Bill 136, while it looks long, it actually has three short topics, which are: the first is we are requiring that the courts impose the minimum fines for DUIs when sentencing. Right now, we have this large system of fines and sentences in place, but there's no actual statutory requirement that those, while we thought those fines meant minimum fines, there is a, I believe it's a Court of Appeals decision that says that the courts can actually waive portions of those fines. So we are changing that in statute so that minimum fines are minimum fines and they have to be part of the sentence. The second section we're changing is on page 4 of the bill. We're expanding the court-ordered treatment programs to also apply to felony cases. So we're expanding it from misdemeanor cases to felony cases. And we are increasing the amount of fines that can be waived for those that are successful in the court-ordered treatment programs from 50% to 75%. So that is actually the three changes that the bill makes, even though it's 9 pages long.
It is long.
It looks long, but it's actually three small topics. So I know that Representative Guerra had a question about, wait till he asks it, or I can just go ahead and address it. He had a question about what happens for payment of the minimum fines for a felony. It's a $10,000 minimum fine, and how do you go about getting that paid if the person doesn't have the means to pay that? It's my understanding the Department of Law, the collections for these fines are sent to the Department of Law. They have their collections department, and they can speak more, hopefully, succinctly on the actual steps they go through, but my understanding is they garnish your permanent fund dividend until your fine is paid off.
Representative Guerra?
Madam Chair, I guess it's the only part of the bill that I've got a concern about is the sort of blood from a stone provisions, which are the fine on page 2 under existing law for many of these DWIs is a minimum of $7,000 for the person. Well, the minimum fines are between $3,000 and $7,000 for the DWIs discussed on page 2. The minimum fine for the felony DWI is $10,000. With all due respect, if you have a single parent who has the terrible judgment to go out and commit as many DWIs as this, ends up getting a $10,000 fine, has a kid who the parent is marginally taken care of at best, and then has to put that next $10,000 into a DWI fine and not the child who is being marginally treated at best. I'm wondering what kind of message we're sending. So I would have no problem if we change this to say that the person's, well, we could garnish the person's PFDs until it's paid off, but I think actually once you become a felon, you don't get a PFD. So I'm not sure about that. But that might be an approach if I'm wrong. We can come up with something more creative. We can come up with a standard that says shall pay unless the person demonstrates that it would harm their family. But if the answer is that it's the choice between harming somebody's family or giving the state money, I go with the family. So I've got some concerns about that part of the bill. It seems awfully blunt.
Okay, those are good questions. We've got, let's see here, what are our resources today? We've got Judge Wanamaker, retired Judge Wanamaker from the Alaska Center for Therapeutic Courts. He might be able to answer some questions. Barb Brink from the Public Defender We've got Doug Woolover here from the court system, Wendy Hamilton with the Juno Therapeutic Corp, and Matt Felix with, I don't know the acronym, NCADD.
Okay.
Somebody's...
Phone lines are down.
Okay, phone lines are down again. Fabulous public process.
Just let us know if...
Okay, so instead, we have Doug Woolover, Wendy Hamilton, and Matt Felix only because they're here in the room. So, did you want to touch on that, Heather, a little bit, what you see the...
I can a little bit, Madam Chairwoman. I understand where Representative Garrett's coming from, but the legislature really worked really hard when they decided to increase these fines, and they put a lot of thought into them, and these fines are here for a reason. And they are the minimums, they're not the maximums, and I believe, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a policy call on whether or not you want to allow a graduated system of the minimums, but these are the minimums, and it is Representative Rookberg's intent that we set these out in statute and that the courts should abide by what the legislature has put forward for the minimums.
Sure. Representative Guerra.
I guess I would ask from Representative Rookberg what happens if you have a single mom who has a terrible DWI problem. She's certainly been irresponsible if she's had that many DWIs, but she's having trouble putting food on the table for her child, or let's say three children, and all of a sudden the first $10,000, why is it more important to give that money to the state than it is to keep the family together?
You don't have to answer that. You can choose to or not. If you think it might impugn your character, don't. Representative Dahlstrom.
You have a right to another attorney.
just a comment. I am sympathetic to the struggle that single parents go through, having been one. And I'm also sympathetic to folks who have been victims of alcohol-related crimes, whether it's, you know, the extreme, a death, or, you know, all the other number of things that can happen in there. And, you know, sometimes there's just natural consequences to our actions. And even though I hear what Representative Guerra is saying, I personally feel that the single parent who makes a choice to go out and drink and gets their fourth DWI and then is fined $7,000 as a minimum, I don't think that they would have probably been making a good decision to use that money to help their family in the first place. And I think that maybe this might be, number four, it might be the wake-up call. We would hope so. We hoped 3 and 2 and 1 would be the wake-up call also, but I also think that this system that we have in place with fines, I think it sends a very strong message to the children of those parents who are not making good choices, and they can learn to break the cycle in their own life and not follow those footsteps. They are, you're correct in that they can sometimes be unfortunate victims of their parents' action. I mean, we see that all the time. That's why we have to have OCS in place. But I just personally am supportive of these fines being, and I would hate to see them lessened, and I really am disappointed we haven't been enforcing them.
Can you, might know this less, can you, or maybe you do, Heather, on a suspended imposition of sentence, is it just the jail time, or can you also have an SIS that includes the fines?
Representative McGuire, I don't think you'd ever qualify for an SIS. An SIS is somebody who hasn't had a criminal record.
It's their first offense.
It's their first offense. This is for somebody who's got who's been completely irresponsible and has had now 3 or 4 DWIs. So, and I agree with Representative Dahlstrom. These are crimes of irresponsibility, and you should collect every last dime that you possibly can. And my question is whether or not we're. And to address a couple of the points, the message being sent to the children is not going to be whether or not they have food put on their table, really. They're not going to think about that and relate that to the crime. They're going to see how long their parent is missing. And in these crimes, you're sent to jail for a year or a good part of the year if you've committed this many DWIs. So I think that's the message that's going to be sent to the child of responsibility and accountability is going to be that their parent's going to be missing for a long time. So I think that will send the message to the family members. And I think you make a good point, and I was a little bit flip in my comments, and frankly they weren't fairly directed at Representative Rookberg's aide, so I apologize, Heather. Representative Rookberg's been so polite this year that somehow I maybe lost it a little bit and misdirected. Maybe misdirected my frustrations. But I think there has to be some sort of out. You know, you must pay the maximum fine over a course of time, maybe. Or, you know, there should be a payment schedule. The fine should not be waived. If the fine should not be waived, but a payment schedule may be established. Or something realistic.
One of the things, though, now I could be wrong, but I don't see in adding a mandatory section, you know, little 2 on line 21, it says shall pay the fine required, but it doesn't specify, at least as I read it, and again, this is part of the stuff we can put on the record, the schedule, how long it will take to pay it back, what the terms of that agreement would be, and I would hope, but ask Ms. Norbrega if it's envisioned that the judge would have the discretion, at least as it pertains to scheduling those payments out in a way that doesn't cause unbearable hardship on a family if it came down to the basics.
Madam Chairwoman, that is my understanding. Judges can work out payment fees, or they send it to the Department of Law, and the Department of Law works out through their collections department how these are going to be collected. We don't have debtor's prisons in Alaska. You don't go to jail until you pay your $10,000 fine. So I think that there are systems in place to work out these fines, and I know you had a question about suspended imposition of sentence. I did put this chart in the back of your packet showing just in Juneau what had happened with suspensions of sentences and fines. There's actually quite a few charts here just from, we got this out of the paper actually, the court records out of the paper, just to indicate to you how the sentences are being imposed here in Juneau. It was harder to track it in other cities, but there's Juneau and Nome because we got it from their paper. And for like the first one listed, the entire $10,000 fine was suspended, and 2 years of his 5-year jail sentence were suspended, or his or her, I'm not sure, but the license was permanently revoked. So this person didn't pay a single dollar in any of the fines that we have mandatory minimums for. And that's just the first one on the long list, almost all of which have a variety of suspension of part of their sentence and a suspension of most, if not all, of their fines, just in Juneau alone.
Hmm. Representative Guerra.
Just so people understand the mechanics, if we say in this bill that you have to pay the fine, even if you can't, which is frankly what the words of the bill will say, we don't have debtor's prisons right now, but the judge will certainly have the authority to put you in jail for the remainder of the suspended part of your sentence if you don't come up with the money. So let's take, for example, somebody with no cash income. They get out of jail, the judge gives them, you know, a year to serve and a year probation. They get out after the year, they don't pay their fine. That extra year of probation can then be revoked if you don't have the money. And I think we can get to everybody's goal, which is to make every ounce of this money, or every last dollar of this money, be paid as quickly as possible. And there might be a provision in the law right now that provides the judge with the authority and by statute to require a payment schedule. And if there is, then my concern's probably satisfied at this point. But if there's not, I'd like to consider adding a payment schedule provision to this, because it's the very rare part of the law that doesn't give the judge the discretion to consider a family's financial reality.
Yeah, Heather, just real quick I'll have Doug come up. Do you have Judge Wanamaker's telephone? We're thinking maybe we could try to improvise and put him on speakerphone because
he's
really
at the LAO.
Okay.
I think he was
all
of
apparently GCI's phone lines went down.
Oh.
I could give you a number for, they may have a cell phone number for him.
I think he's going to be the person, having been a person handing out sentences, that's going to know where that, what that discretion encompasses. So, now, Doug.
I have a mobile number for him.
Maybe. So we'll do that. Mr. Wilbur, do you want to come up and see if we can, we'll take your testimony.
I'm talking to them right now, and I'm going to put them on speaker.
Okay, good. Thanks, Doug. You want to go ahead and start? Thanks.
For the record, my name is Doug Wilbur. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska Court System. The only provisions of this bill that I was prepared to speak on today are those that are, that serve as incentives to participate in the therapeutic court programs. And those the court does support. As you know, the court is a big champion of therapeutic courts. We like them. We think they work. We think they save money, and we think they save lives. And those provisions in the bill that encourage people to participate in that, both through reduced fines and through by the provisions that allow felony defendants to participate, we think are a good thing, and we support those provisions.
So that's all. So you have no official comment on the fine or the discretion. Any? Do you have any awareness about how the
payment plan,
if payment plans are
payment
allowed?
Plans are available. They're oftentimes used by judges. Judges disagree on amongst themselves the extent to which you can suspend mandatory minimum fines. They vary like everyone else does on the merits of the bill. Not on the bill, but on that issue. But payment schedules can be and routinely are set up.
Oh, cool. I can do that.
I don't know how effective they are. It's not something I'm particularly familiar with.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a couple questions on their authority to impose a payment schedule. If we pass this bill the way it's written, would the judges retain the authority? Would they retain the authority to impose the fine through a payment schedule?
To the Chair, Representative Guerra, yes, they would.
And so should I then not have any worry that, let's say the sentence is a year to serve and a year of probation, and then you can get that other year imposed if you violate your probation conditions, or should I have any worry that that extra year of probation might be turned into jail time if somebody doesn't have enough money to pay the fine in time?
Through the Chair, Representative Garrett, I don't really know. But if we can get Judge Wanamaker on, I'm sure he's much more.
He's doing the direct dial. I was told by the Incavelio that if he calls them directly,
okay,
he can get them on.
So we're in the process.
I could guess. But he
Representative Garrett?
Just one last question. It was just mentioned that there was a Court of Appeals opinion that said you don't have to pay the minimum fine. Were there any standards that came with that opinion that says you don't have to if you can demonstrate you can't pay, or was it just flat you don't have to pay it?
Representative Guerra, I think the opinion might be, it was in the packets that were out there. It's been a while since I've read that opinion. My understanding was the opinion basically said there was nothing in the statute that's, there was a mandatory jail time, and it specifically said the mandatory minimum jail time may not be suspended, as I recall, and there was no similar language for the fine. So this has been around for a long time, but
so that's the appeals opinion that the different trial courts are interpreting differently.
Well, I don't, through the Chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know if they interpret it differently or they just disagree as to whether it's appropriate. I really don't know.
So should we test to see if they're on? Do we need to do anything?
Are they on? Judge Wanamaker? Judge Wanamaker, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Good.
Wanamaker here. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay.
Good to have you on board. We just finished, Doug Wilbur just talked to us a little bit about it, but basically what the committee has been discussing is to what degree a judge has discretion over payment plans or how these mandatory fines will be paid out. And Representative Guerra's concern that sparked the discussion was, what about a family where you've got a, you know, admittedly bad mom or dad that keeps making dumb choices, but in having to pay this back, if it's a choice between paying the electricity bill or food, putting food on the table, he's saying, you know, rather have that for the kids. Why should they have to suffer? So What type of discretion do you believe a judge would have in setting up a payment plan or making sure that it wasn't hardship?
Sure, I'd be glad to tell how that works. The practice in Anchorage is that the judge will just set a due date for the fine. So if it's a $3,000 fine with $1,500 suspended, $1,500, he might, if it's, you know, somebody without real resources, say it's due in 1 year. And then if it's not paid within the 1 year, it becomes a civil matter. It's taken over by the Department of Law, and they pursue them just like a civil judgment, and oftentimes work out a payment plan to get the fine paid.
So that answers your question about going back to jail. Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Wanamaker, this is Les Guerra speaking. The part of the bill we're talking about, I know it's not the part that you came to testify on, but I just want to make sure I understand the ramifications of this bill. We're talking about the minimum DWI fine, and this bill would say that the minimum DWI fine shall be paid, because I guess some judges have been waiving it in some circumstances. And so I'm looking at, so I've got a couple questions. There are the misdemeanor fines, and I, if I'm reading this correctly, for somebody who's been convicted twice before, the minimum fine is $4,000. So let's use that as an example. Is that correct? If you've been convicted twice before, that $4,000 fine, that's for a misdemeanor. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. It may well be. I don't have the table in front of me. We all keep on the bench. When I was on the bench, we'd have a table of the minimum fines right there, but. Just somewhere in that range. My recollection is $3,000 on the second misdemeanor DUI.
Thanks, Judge. Yeah, I'm reading it really quickly. It has I'll represent to you that the current law seems to say if you've convicted twice, you've been convicted twice before, it's 60 days in jail as a minimum and 4,000 as a minimum. Three times before, 120 days as a minimum, 5,000 as a minimum. In the misdemeanor world. Does the court have jurisdiction for more than a year? Because I'm a little worried that if we impose this $5,000 minimum fine in a misdemeanor, and the person can't pay that $5,000 in the time between when they get out of jail and that year is up, that the court doesn't have any authority beyond that. Or am I wrong on that in a misdemeanor case? Does the court's authority end after a year in a misdemeanor case, or it gets to continue?
Theoretically, you could tinker with the due date on the fine. Is that the question?
I guess in a misdemeanor case, does the court have authority to keep monitoring the case and monitoring the payment for longer than a year, or does their jurisdiction end after that year?
No, there's nothing magical about 1 year. A judge could utilize a longer time.
Okay.
But just the prevailing practice is hardly anybody would go beyond a year.
Okay. So I'm comforted on that. And then if we pass this bill that said the minimum fine shall be paid, and let's say it's a $5,000 minimum, are you comfortable that a judge who felt a payment plan would be appropriate would be allowed to continue to use the payment plan approach if we pass this bill?
You're thinking of something like you pay $100 a month, kind of a plan?
Yeah.
Probably just because there's such a volume of cases and that involves so many details that it just isn't done. I mean, typically the judge will say, you know, the fine is due in 1 year or it's due in 9 months. And then, as I said before, if it isn't paid, it goes over to civil collection by the Attorney General's office and is handled just like a civil debt. I've never seen anyone have a petition to revoke probation for failure to pay a fine.
Okay.
In other words, it just shifts to the civil arena and the Department of Law. Civil attorneys collect the money.
And could I be comfortable that for failure to pay the fine, probation? Well, forget about that for a second.
I was on the bench 11 years. I've never seen it.
Okay. And And the payment, I guess the judge could say payment within 2 years if the judge wanted to also?
Yes.
Okay. And then I guess just what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts as a judge as to what the effect would be to make all of the DWI minimum fines mandatorily payable?
Well, I think this is just kind of a housekeeping matter, that part of House Bill 136. I'd always taken the view that minimum means minimum and that it had to be paid. So I don't think it'll make much of a change. There just was a few judges that suspended below the minimum fine.
Okay. Thanks, Judge. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Hey, and is Judge Wanamaker anything else? Obviously, you probably want to add to the testimony of, in your support of the bill.
Okay. Chairwoman McGuire, thank you for that opportunity. And I would just emphasize I'm now retired as a judge, that I've gotten rejuvenated by a month on the beach in Maui.
Oh, lovely. You deserved
it. Yeah, it was good. That was a nice retirement. And now I'm ready to testify with enthusiasm on behalf of 136, House Bill 136. I'm testifying as the new director for the Alaska Center for Therapeutic Justice, which is a division of Partners for Progress. And I'm talking about the provisions of Sections 3 and 6, which would extend the wellness court to felony and I know that we all dread the horror of the DUI-caused highway crash that kills and maims. And the single best way to prevent that is to get DUI defendants into lasting sobriety. And the Wellness Court model does that through a program that's tougher than jail and gives defendants the tools to maintain lasting sobriety. It's a proven model. The new there's new wellness courts at the misdemeanor level that are forming in Juneau and Ketchikan and possibly in Fairbanks. And these new courts can easily process the felony DUI offenders. And it'll be a very cost-effective approach. And I would emphasize it's a great time to be doing this, as Chairman Ruppert pointed out in his, Representative Ruppert pointed out in his comments concerning the bill. There's a big emphasis by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to fund this type of court, and there's a wealth of startup money available. So it's a really opportune time. And I hope you'll report the bill out of committee with a due pass recommendation. I'm prepared to answer any questions if there are some.
Thank you very much, Judge Wanamaker. I wonder if you haven't seen this, I'll have Vanessa, see if she can get you a copy. I just got this today. It's from the SCAIFE Family Foundation, SCAIFE, and it's dated February 2005, and it goes through a whole summary of the economic benefits of drug treatment, and it's really amazing. It goes through a bunch of the different programs in other states and absolutely shows the economic benefits from reduced crime, including incarceration and victimization costs and so on. Anyway, interesting. I didn't know if you'd seen that yet.
Oh, I'd appreciate it if you could forward that to me.
We will do so.
I've seen other studies that show you save $10 for every dollar spent, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra has a question.
Thanks. Judge, it's... I feel like Rain Man here. I'm probably going to ask you somewhat of the same question again. I just want to make sure I understand something. So I'm more comforted by the bill given the payment plan provisions that are the delayed payment date that the judge can impose. But I'm wondering if the judge has a suspended portion of the sentence and the person doesn't pay the fine in time, I mean, I know you've said you haven't seen a judge revoke the remaining jail time or revoke probation and send somebody to jail, but wouldn't the judge have to under this provision if the payment were ordered and the law were now mandatory, you have to make the payment, and the person doesn't in time, does the judge have any real option other than to...
Well, yeah. Actually, I can answer that. The judge doesn't really have any power to do that until a petition to revoke probation has been filed by the district attorney, and there's been case law on that. So the judge can't even act until the district attorney files a petition to revoke probation. And as I said, they've got it worked out to handle it civilly, and they never ever file a petition to revoke probation for failure to pay a fine.
Thanks, Judge.
It does, in fact, shift to the civil arena.
Any further questions for Judge Wanamaker? Okay, well, congratulations on your retirement, and we look forward to working with you as a House Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
Okay, so... I'm sorry, I'm trying to find my... There it is. Okay, so next is Wendy Hamilton with the Juno Therapeutic Court. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of House Bill 136. This is, all three parts of it are, in my mind, housekeeping details. The first one has to do with extending the rights of a person graduating from wellness court, extending it from misdemeanor to felony. That's very much needed. The Juno court is going to be a misdemeanor and a felony DWI court combined. And in my mind, the felony DWIs are just another higher level of risk. So it just seems to be a housekeeping piece to extend that, the rights that misdemeanor graduates get to felony graduates. The other piece about increasing the amount of fines from 50% to 75% actually goes hand in hand with the last piece, which is when you're trying to provide incentives for someone to face 18 months minimum in a wellness court, which is a lot of hard work. It's a lot of hard work. And you want to have incentives to do that. If you're telling someone you can have a 50 or a 75% reduction in your fine, and he's saying, yeah, but Joe Schmo got zero, then you lose one of the big carrots. It's a big carrot. And having worked 2.5 years for felony probation and parole, I can tell you, Representative Guerra, that no one's ever been sent back to jail, even on felony probation, for not paying their fine. And they always work out a monthly payment plan that is amenable to that person, usually $100 a month. They're allowed to even miss a month or two, and then they'll usually get called on by their PO, but nobody's ever sent back to jail for their fines, and they are eventually turned over to the Attorney General's office, and if they get off probation and they're still there, they do go, as Judge Wanamaker said, for collections. So fines are one of the bites that you can have, jail and fines, and that's why that third piece is very much needed for the second piece to work.
Questions? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and your patience. I know you guys have been here a long time. Okay, Matt Felix. Spell out your say out the full name of your organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Felix. I'm with the National Council of Alcoholism and Drug Dependence here in Juneau, and we're a national organization that's been incorporated in Juneau since 1965, so we're one of the oldest nonprofits here. And we do a lot of drug and alcohol treatment prevention. We are the recipient of the federal money for the Juneau Therapeutic Court and administer the Juneau Therapeutic Court in conjunction with the state court system. I'd just like to say that this, repeat really what Judge Wanamaker said, and this is a cleanup language that we need after experiencing therapeutic courts, filling in the gaps, making the courts work better, and making them have more of a carrot as well as a punitive approach, and letting the individual get forced into treatment and have the treatment system take over and try to turn these individuals around so they don't get a fourth DWI or fifth DWI through that combination stick. And I can address, Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Guerra's question. Basically, it's been our experience that looking at the data from the different courts that a lot of the fine ends up being waived if the individual complies. And that's the third part of this. It's allows even 75% of that fine to be waived. They get credit for treatment fees. They get credit for therapy. They get credit for a lot of the things they're ordered to do. And the judge has the discretion to credit that towards their fine and waive that. So a $10,000 fine may seem like a lot, but if they continue in therapeutic court, do well, stay sober, don't drive, and all the things that are required of them, they may end up paying a fourth of that in actual consequences.
So you're really seeing it work?
It is, Your Honor. We're a recipient of Department of Transportation money. Normally, Justice Department funded these courts for years, but the reason the Transportation Department is funding them now at the federal level is because it's the only thing that works. For years, they've tried to stop DWI fatalities and have not had luck by spending millions and millions of dollars on cop cars and infrared guns and stuff like this, and nothing's worked over the years. And they finally tagged on to sort of the Department of Justice in targeting DWIs, like the Department of Justice was tagging on other felons and using the therapeutic model. I'd just like to remind the committee that in Alaska, the reason the federal money is pouring into this state is we have the worst DWI on a per capita basis and the worst fatality rate on a per capita basis in any state. As you know, that a lot of fatality rates have dropped from 50% of total auto fatalities down to around the 35 to 40% area in most states. We have remained at 50%. Over the years, over the last 15, 20 years, it's a sad figure. And not only that, a higher percentage, up to a third of those fatalities were created by multiple DWIs. So that's why the Department of Transportation now has focused their highway safety money into Alaska and into this model, because we sort of stick out like a sore thumb in those areas.
And then final question, just kind of a off the subject but related. We passed a bill last year that looked at requiring interlock devices. Do you have any experience in how those are working and if you've seen any success with that?
Yes, Madam Chair. They're not working in Alaska yet, but in other states they are part of the sentence, and they seem to be one of the tools that they can use in this model of therapeutic court model as well, be part of a sentence. You gave us the ability to use them. It's a matter of finances and whatnot. I think they're about $1,500 a piece. And it's one of the tools like ankle bracelets and sobrieters, telephone systems, and electronic monitoring that is used among the courts. And each court has the authority to use the different models because of what's available in the community, you see.
Yeah.
So, that's great that you gave us that ability, and I think you'll see them in this someday.
Yeah, the statistics were pretty amazing when we looked at that bill, that they really serve as an intervention point.
Right.
You can't start your car, so.
They're part of a whole system of, of a combination of getting the individual turned around and get the drinking stopped so that the fatalities stop.
Anything else? Anything further? Thank you very much. Sure, appreciate it. So, is teleconferencing up and going again? Do we have our phone lines? Okay, that was just an isolated, just encourage for both Representative Meyer and for the Division of Elections that if you have anybody that's critical to your bill's passage, we did facilitate Judge Wanamaker's testimony by contacting him on his mobile phone and having him call in directly. So if that's a critical part of your bill, go ahead and let us know and we can do that. Otherwise, the GCI phone lines are down in the LAO, so we won't hear from the other folks. Okay, anybody else in the audience to testify on House Bill 136? Anybody online? Obviously not. So with that, we'll close public testimony, and that brings the bill back before us. Representative Dahlstrom.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion. I would like to move House Bill 136 with accompanying physical notes and individual recommendations.
An objection? Representative Guerra, speaking to your objection?
Actually, I probably don't have any objection to it. I just would like to have us consider a letter of intent that would just solidify what we've heard in testimony. I think I've become convinced that the bill's policy is fine. That the minimum fine part is fine, that the practice that the state engages in when somebody doesn't pay their fine is fine. But I would hate for it to all change after this, right? I guess if they're not revoking probation for somebody's inability to pay a fine right now and they're going the civil route, and that's what the testimony is from Judge Wanamaker and the others, I would like a letter of intent that would say that we intend for that to remain the practice, which is that a failure to pay a fine should not be turned into a means to revoke the remaining portion of the unserved part of the sentence, but should be dealt with civilly, as it is right now.
I don't have any problem in theory supporting that, but I would like to see it in writing. And so you have a couple choices. The first would be, you know, to object and see what the vote is to hold it up, or the second would be to craft a letter of intent that would go on then to the Finance Committee for consideration there, or it could be taken up on the floor. Which you know how much Norm loves that. So
yeah, that's
if you're really looking at an opportunity to pay Norm back, I think that would be fun for you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gira.
Yeah, actually, if we could hold off on moving this bill out until the end of the committee, I can probably scratch out a few sentences and then move that before we move the bill out.
I would be willing to do that.
Great.
I'll set it aside to wait and see what you come up with. Representative Anderson.
I was just going to, thank you, Madam Chair, add to Representative Gere, if you could add in the letter something about the wellness court and what we've heard about Interlock, and these are maybe innovative, or I don't know if we want to endorse that because that wouldn't be appropriate for the committee, but we're talking about treatment programs and others, and there's been advocacy for these programs. Maybe a line in there.
In our endorsement for the wellness.
I don't know about endorsement, but just to say that we recognize that these are valuable tools for rehabilitation and allowing people to get back to work, which is wellness court and the Interlock system and those.
Sure.
Thanks.
So, yes, Representative Dahlstrom, if you'd kindly withdraw your motion for now.
Madam Chair, withdraw my motion.
Okay. So we will set House Bill 136 to the side, awaiting the letter of intent. And that brings House Bill number 116. Okay. Fantastic.
Madam Chair, is 116 a Meyer bill? Because I just like to move it out of committee. He's a busy man.
I love it. Love it. You must have something up for finance, huh?
I'm sure he does.
Hey, Representative Meyer, welcome to House Judiciary.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Basically, just in a nutshell, what this bill does is it protects minors who are working with enforcement officers in enforcing compliance checks against liquor licenses. Last session at the request of the Municipality of Anchorage and I believe it's Brown Jug and some of the other establishments, I sponsored House Bill 428, which created a civil penalty for violations of Alaska Statute 4.16.060, and I'll explain what that is. Alaska Statute 4.16.049 and 065 allow a person with an alcoholic beverage license to bring a civil action against a person that violates the provisions of 0.049 and 0.060. And these activities that I mentioned under these statutes include a minor knowingly entering or remaining on a licensed premise, a minor soliciting others to purchase alcohol for them, a person purchasing alcohol for a minor, or a person presenting false identification to a licensee. The problem and the reason why we're bringing this bill forward is that volunteers are cooperating with law enforcement in an active investigation are not exempt from the liability provisions of these statutes. Compliance checks are an important enforcement tool. We need to use them. Young people are working with our law enforcement and should not be subject to the civil action for their participation. And I think in your backup here, you'll see that alcohol still is the drug of choice amongst our youth. And actually, I'm a victim of these compliance checks. My first week here in Juneau, I went to I don't know if I should admit this.
Attention.
I went to A&P, I think it is, at Foodland, and I got some groceries, and I went next door to get a bottle of wine or a six-pack of beer or something, and I walked out and two kids stopped me and said, "Hi, we're underage. Would you buy for us?" And I said, "Of course not." And fortunately, that's the right answer. they pulled out a little sticker saying that, you know, they're with a Youth for Action and they're on a compliance check. And And one kid had braces. I mean, he was only 14. It was pretty obvious. And the lady was 19. She was a little closer, but still, it was pretty obvious that they were underage. And so it wasn't like they were trying to trick me into something. But clarifying that persons cooperating with law enforcement in an active investigation are exempt from civil liability provisions will ensure that the licensees don't try to bring action against these kids, which has happened, and I believe it was in Fairbanks, where they didn't like the program, so they were kind of taking that out on the kids who are helping our law enforcement to enforce the program. This will take that off the books, that's not an option. And also, it helps law enforcement who do not have to go through the process of defending themselves and the kids in a lawsuit. So today, you should hear from, if everything's working with, from the ABC board, Doug Griffin, and others with the MAD program who are involved with the compliance checks. I do appreciate you taking this bill up for consideration and available for any questions, Madam Chair.
Great. Questions for the bill sponsor?
Great bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Meyer. Do we have Doug Griffin on the line?
Yes, you do, Madam Chairman.
How are you, Doug?
Very good.
Good. Why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony?
I'll keep it brief. Representative Meyer's done a good job of, I think, of framing the question and the need for this bill. Just generally speaking, let me tell the committee I have Bill Roach, chief enforcement officer for the ABC board, is sitting with me, and of course, Bill is more hands-on and is the primary supervisor of our compliance check program. But it has been a very effective program. It's a fairly simple way to put people on notice that they need to take greater care in making sure they don't serve alcohol to underage persons. Sort of in management parlance, it's the way to pick the low hanging fruit, because it is not it's not that complicated, but it does involve an underage person going on to a licensed premises. We try to be very careful. We are very careful when it's under our control in making sure that we don't mislead or lie about the age of the person. We don't use phony IDs. We try to use people that are obviously, as Representative Meyer described, obviously underage. So we don't see our compliance check program as any way of trying to entrap anybody. Any reasonable individual would say this person at least needs to be carded and probably denied alcohol because of their appearance. But there is the problem with Representative Meyer taking the proactive approach with his civil penalties that can be brought about by the licensees. It does kind of, one of the, I guess, unforeseen things was that it can be used as a weapon to try to brunt the effectiveness of our compliance check program, which has been very effective. When we first started, had not done any of this, we were having failure rates approaching 50%, right at 50%. And now, after having conducted this program here for a few years, it's down to under 10%. So, you know, it's, and without spending a whole lot of money, actually, you know, maybe less than $100,000 a year for a statewide program. So it provides the deterrent effect. It's effective, but we do need this bill to clean up some of the potential problems that could be brought about from licensees that don't like it, the fact that we're out there trying to make sure that they're toeing the line by guarding our underage people from the potential of being sued. That concludes my testimony, and Bill and I are here to answer any questions and assist the committee any way we can.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Roach or Mr. Griffin? Okay, hearing none, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, anybody else here in the audience to testify on House Bill 116? Yes? Come forward.
Hi, I'm Jessica Paris. I formerly worked for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I now work with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. And for the last 2.5 years, I've been working on underage drinking prevention. And I guess I'm here today to speak on behalf of the teens that I have worked with. I've participated in the operations that Mr. Griffin has described, the compliance checks and the shoulder taps. In fact, I witnessed Representative Meyer make the right choice in the Angie parking lot.
Good thing.
And I just want to say, when I have talked to law enforcement about doing compliance checks, they say the issue that's always difficult for them is finding agents, finding these, you know, teenage agents. And so that's sort of what my job became. And some of the issues you face in trying to recruit and retain teens for this is it's kind of sporadic work. Like, they might only work a few weekends in a year, and so it's not an ongoing job, and they've got lots of other commitments. They have to typically be between age 18 and 19, or that's what's preferred, and so they might work, they might do a few weekends of operations, and then they have their 20th birthday or something, and so they're no longer eligible to do it. They can't be drinking, which is, that can be challenging, trying to find some 18, 19-year-olds who don't consume alcohol. And just lastly, as you can imagine, just kind of it takes some courage, I think, to go in and work with law enforcement to potentially shut down a source of alcohol to their peers. So those are some of the challenges that are involved in finding teen agents. And so it's frustrating when these, I think, brave and courageous teens then have to face this fear of being sued $1,000 for the work that they're doing. And one of the agents that I worked with is facing a lawsuit right now from a liquor store in Fairbanks, who I think, as Mr. Griffin pointed out, is just, angry or upset or wants to sort of defy the compliance check system. So I think that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Dying to ask who it is in Fairbanks, but I won't. I figure John will tell us.
I'm sure I'll find out sooner or later.
John will tell us. He'll do the reconnaissance. Okay. Anybody else in the audience to testify on House Bill 116? Anybody that managed to make it through on a phone line? Okay. Then I'll close public testimony. That brings the bill back before us. I understand there's an amendment being offered, at least one.
Yeah, so I don't have anything in.
Well, that's the letter of
intent. Oh, that's the letter of intent. Pardon me. You're not going to offer
it? No, I am.
Okay. So Representative Gruenberg.
Okay. It's an amendment. And I'm sorry, I don't have it written, Madam Chair. I can't prepare one in writing. It's on line 7 and on line 13, the same thing. Delete the phrase, the person, and insert comma, supervises, comma. So it would read, if the peace officer accompanies, comma, supervises, comma, or otherwise observes the person entry or remaining on premises. And the reason for that in both cases is that as these operations continue and get more sophisticated, they may be wiring the people, and they're not officially accompanying them or visually observing, but they're supervising them. And I'd offer that as Amendment 1.
I feel really happy. I think it's a good amendment. Mm-hmm. Any objection to it? Amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. Any further amendments to House Bill 116?
If I may.
Representative Kroenberg.
Did Fish bring you up through the chair, bring you up to date on what else we discussed?
He did.
Honorable Fish.
Honorable. For the record, Madam Chairman, that's Michael Pulowski for Representative
Fish. Fish.
There'll be a key that accompanies all the minutes where you're here.
The reason is because we had talked about one other thing, too, that dealt with making this applicable to section 0.050, 0.051, and 0.052, identical language. And do we have the folks from the ABC on?
See if they're still there. Are you still there, Doug? Nope. They've left the building.
Elvis has left.
I think Mr. Pulowski has been researching this.
Mr. Pulowski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To bring up on our discussion this morning, I can say that Representative Gruenberg and I had a conversation with the ABC board. And looking forward, for the committee's purposes, 050 is possession, control, or consumption by persons under the age of 21. 051 is furnishing or delivery of alcoholic beverages to persons under 21. And 052 is furnishing of alcoholic beverages to persons under the age of 21 by licensees. So there are several different enforcement issues in our alcohol and beverage laws that are covered in those three other sections. Looking forward, the exemption from liability, the ABC board did find valid and helpful. And they looked at it going forward in case anyone wanted to add a civil liability provision to one of these sections. The issue being currently that a civil liability provision for 050, 051, and 052 does not exist. And it's very clear under Title 11 that criminal liability isn't there because you are accompanying a peace officer. So that the gray area is in and around the civil liability, which House Bill 116 addresses in the Section 1 and Section 2 for those specific sections. So expanding it out brings in any possible, broadens the title to the point where you could also be dealing with issues in 050, 051, 052. And I know there are issues out there that people would like to deal with in those specific statutes. So seeing that it's not necessary, the Alcohol and Beverage Board liked the idea, but getting to the liability provisions, we didn't think it was quite necessary.
Does that answer your concern, Representative Gruenberg?
I'm not going to, if the sponsor doesn't prefer I didn't, I won't. I kind of thought when we and Sarah, my staff, talked to them, it was my impression that they kind of supported that. But, you know, I don't want to get crosswise with you, but it was my feeling that they thought it was a good idea, but I don't know.
Take care of that, will you?
You're making everybody.
Animal channel. I keep it on.
Get that amendment.
Madam Chair, I do appreciate it. I appreciate the amendment and appreciate Representative Gruenberg bringing it forward, but we just don't see that it's necessary because in those sections you can't be held civilly liable, so it's not necessary.
It's moved, yeah. Okay, that's good enough for me. Any further amendments to House Bill 116? Representative Garrett?
Chair, would this be an appropriate time to talk about capital requests for the Pioneers Home?
No.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Vanessa informed me that our Peace Corps bill's up next week, so that brings the bill back before us. Any further discussion? Okay, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill 116, Version G, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Version F.
Oh, as I apologize. Amended. Version F.
Version F as amended, individual recommendations. Okay. Thank you. Is there any objection to that motion? Okay. Hearing none, it is moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for your time. Thanks for coming down, Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You didn't leave me gone.
Like it.
3:30. Kind of need to go now.
At least if we'll get started, and then you guys can head to Labor and Commerce.
Are you going to vote?
I don't think we'll move it out today anyway, so we can just, if you
what
guys.
What are you talking about?
We have to go to the other meeting. It's always the.
We'll take a brief, Eddie's. If you.
We'll stay.
Let's go back then to House Bill number 136. We have the letter of intent drafted by Representative Kira.
Madam Chair, I move the insertion of the letter of intent. I move the letter of intent on HB 136.
And I'm trying to think. I think the motion has to go after we move the bill. So we'll just to hold off for just a sec. So first, Representative Dahlstrom, if you'd move the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 136. Version Y with accompanying physical notes and individual recommendations.
There were no amendments, I take it?
Nope. Unamended.
Unamended.
Okay, so any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, the bill is moved. And then Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the letter of intent to HB 136.
Okay, is there any objection to the movement of the letter of intent? Okay, hearing none, the letter of intent will accompany House Bill 136. And thank you very much, Ms. Nobrega. Okay, so just if you guys will sign these sheets. We will get started with Ms. Glazier.
I don't trust you.
And our heavy duty election bill. House Bill number 94.
Madam Chair, Laura Glazier, Director, Division of Elections. As you see by an extensive sectional and a 58-section bill, this is an omnibus repair election bill. We started this as House Bill 523 last year, and it got caught up in the process. And so we made another run at it this year with House Bill 94. I don't know how you'd like me to proceed. If you'd like me to do some of the highlights of the bill, would you like to go section by section?
Whatever you think will sell it.
If I understood that, we probably wouldn't have been in state affairs as long as we were.
Yes.
The housekeeping changes that we need in this bill are simple, and I'll highlight those quickly. The change of the phrase work sites to construction sites. Presumptive evidence of a voter's address is their record and not the voter card. Defining nonpartisan and undeclared voters in statute. Protecting voter information of domestic violence victims in accord with confidentiality laws improved last year. Defining the process for independent candidates for president and vice president. Ensuring consistency in the definition of overseas voters. Making clear age requirements for serving once elected. Clearly setting out recognized political party status and the qualification standards for parties. Changes to Title 29 to clearly define qualified voter as one who is registered to vote within the proposed borough or municipality at least 30 days prior to an election. The definition of re-registration and repealing duplicative language regarding regional supervisors' offices as absentee voting stations. Additionally, some key points that came about this year, we would offer to allow a voter through power of attorney to allow another to register to vote or make changes to their registration or to fill out an application for a by-mail absentee ballot.
Okay.
This past election year, we had many families who came to us asking for that, for the men and women that were serving overseas, and we offered it up as a policy call to the legislature. State Affairs worked on the language. Representative Gruenberg helped us. You'll see that set out in the first few sections of the bill. We reduced the witnessing requirements for absentee by mail or electronic transmission from two witnesses to one witness. In House State Affairs, they removed the caveat that witness must be a U.S. citizen. Again, a policy call of the legislature. We add scanning as another means to transmit voter registration or by mail absentee ballot requests to the division. The division currently accepts these forms in person, by mail, or by fax. The phrase electronic transmission, we were told, was not clear enough to allow for somebody to scan their voter registration application and attach it as an email, so we're offering those changes to statute here in this bill. In-house state affairs, requirement for the division to implement ballot rotation for the names of those candidates running for governor, lieutenant governor, United States senator, United States representative, and state senator on ballots printed for each House district. Placement of the name of candidates for state House races will appear in random order as determined by the director, as is the current process. Ballot rotation will not occur for candidates for state House. Current law requires the director to determine a random order for all candidates placed on ballots used in each House district. So that was a change made.
So it will not occur random?
It will occur random for members who are running for House, for state House, but not for state Senate. Random for House, ballot rotation, every race above that, state Senate and up. And the reason that was offered was when you start ballot rotation in the House, there's increased fiscal note. In addition, that rotation means higher burden on the division as far as providing those rotated ballots in each of the precincts, and so each time that goes down an extra level, you set a higher burden, and it did raise the fiscal note. So it's offered in House State Affairs to take it to House District, which would not require additional printing or provision of additional ballots for absentee voting sites.
Is there any evidence that having your, I've always wondered that, that having your name first on the ballot really gives you a, an advantage?
There are certainly studies that say that and others that do not, but that's what it's
based on. Dr. Joe Sonneman, who has researched this and taken the case to the Supreme Court.
Fascinating.
What we did, and we have some charts that we'll pass out that did it. So in other words, everybody would be, who's on the ballot in District 1, would be given an order. And the folks who are for the House District 1, the ballots would be the same. For House District 2, if there are two candidates for the Senate, they would then reverse. And if there were three people for governor, it would be, instead of A, B, C, it would B, C, A. And then in District 3, it would be C, A, B, and then it would rotate again.
Yeah.
And so everybody gets rotation except the people in the House, because there would be a fiscal note otherwise. And by the way, last year in the State Affairs Committee, there was a mini revolt, and they wanted, everybody said, we want to have everybody rotate. So it would be perfect rotation. You know, like if I got a ballot and then you did and you did and you did, we'd all get it rotated. But that would have required like 180 different ballots, and it would have been a real expense, so we didn't pursue it this time.
Incredible amount of ballot styles. And also to note, in this rotation, because it's rotated per state senate, there can only be two rotations for state senate candidates. So if in fact there are three candidates for state senate, one person will never be on the top. So that's, it's not, again, it's not perfect rotation, but it's
and if we had a Schwarzenegger situation with 160 people running for governor,
jeez,
only 40 make it for the top.
Ms. Clady? Cool. Representative Guerra?
No, when you're ready for the next subject.
Towards the integrity of elections, we improve ballot security by adding that ballots will not be mailed to a voter whose address has already been identified as undeliverable. Now election boards must report the number of ballots destroyed to increase accountability of ballots, and adds a standard for voting machines and vote tally systems. Great deal. A lot of the sections of the bill deal with petitions, referendum, and recall. Improvements to these sections are suggested to make the process more user-friendly for Alaskans and to make these acts of petitioning our government more consistent. We add the printed name and date of birth as identifiers for a petition signer. This should help the division to be able to more readily qualify a voter's signature. Qualifications for a circulator of a petition to comply with the Buckley decision. They do not have to be registered voters, but must be 18 years of age or older, a U.S. citizen, and an Alaskan resident. Language that was the basis for the division requiring accountability reports from petition sponsors has been removed. This was noted in the Hinneberger decision as an undue burden or barrier to petition carriers. Removes language requiring the circulator's name to be prominently displayed on the petition. While not enforced by the division since the Buckley decision in 2000, statutory changes have not been made to date, and they're offered here. And removes language concerning an additional 100 signatures when filing a recall petition. Current law requires 10% of those who voted in the preceding general election to be included as sponsors, but it's not clear about the 100 signatures. We learned that in the last recall effort, and so we're removing the 100 signature notation here. So that's kind of a in-capsule 58 section.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first, Ms. Glazer, I'd like to just say thank you for all the work that your division does. I don't think anyone in any party affiliation could question the dedication of you and your staff, and I am grateful for what you do, and I am also very impressed with the integrity of the system that is set up. Had opportunity to witness and just be a part of seeing a couple recalls and recounts, different things like that, and I was extremely impressed, and so I want to thank you, and the hours that you put in are just incredible. And the second question is, you mentioned in State Affairs that they changed the fact that we don't we now only need one witness, and that witness does not need to be a U.S. citizen. And my first impulse is that disturbs me. Can you give me what your thoughts are about that?
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, it disturbs me as well, but I have to give you the full testimony, which is we require that witness be a U.S. citizen. Current law, there was no requirement that you be a U.S. citizen on the by mail part, but there was it by fax, and there were two witnesses required in both, by mail and by fax. Only in by fax were you required to be a U.S. citizen. Those of you that remember when Representative Martin carried the by fax legislation, that was a higher standard, and they saw by fax as a last option, not as an equal option. We are seeing that start to change and it come together. We decided to take it down to one witness, but require that they be a U.S. citizen because we felt that this is a United States election process, and even if you're overseas, you're affecting the election, of people in our country. There was work done by another representative and asked the Federal Voting Assistance Program, and 39 states do not require you to be a U.S. citizen, and they believe that sets a higher bar for people to match to find a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, sure.
So the committee voted and they removed that option to be.
I think you may have to find it in here.
Witnesses. Again, the division can't verify that, but the witness does sign an oath. So we go on good stead that, in fact, they are a U.S. citizen.
Representative Guerra.
Representative Dostmar. A couple concerns. One is there's Section 19 that says that the Division of Elections can use any machine that the FEC has said is okay, which causes me makes me think about my bill last year to say that election machine should always have a paper ballot. And I want to make sure that this doesn't allow the Division of Elections to violate that provision.
No, Representative Guerin, through the chair. In fact, Representative Gruenberg added the last two lines 25 and 26 on page 12, that the director may only approve a voting machine or vote tally system if the machine or system satisfies the requirement of 15-15-03-032C, and that was your language.
Thanks. So, I was just looking that up, and I only have a year-old version of the statute books.
We believe that we would have set that standard anyway because yours says shall, but this is additional in this language dealing with standards for voting machines that we are required to follow that sectional law.
Super. That was my major concern. Go ahead.
The one individual rather than the U.S. citizen, that only appears at the top of page 11, is that, or does it appear elsewhere besides
it appears,
that?
And then on line 25 of page 11 as well, because it's in by mail, the by mail section as well as the through electronic transmission.
It was Gabrielle Ledoux. Yes. May I? Okay. This bill has taken more of my time than any other. We were going to make. Actually, in State Affairs, we made Ms. Glazer an honorary member of the committee. She was there so much. That's on the record. The question that was asked by Representative Dahlstrom a second ago was about the leading the requirement of a U.S. citizen. And again, that is on page 10 and 11. It's at the top of page 10. Line 1, and on line 27, huh?
No, it's on, I have it on page 11, line 1, and then line 25.
Line 25. But that it never said U.S. citizen there. Oh, okay, because there was an amendment or something that
Correct.
Was going to do it.
Correct.
Okay, well, we had some considerable testimony by Ms. Ledoux and her staff. People, when they're traveling outside the U.S., sometimes have difficulty finding somebody who's a U.S. citizen. And this was to assist them to be able to vote And the feeling was that whether the person is a citizen or not wouldn't necessarily make it more prevent fraud or not. So that we really didn't need to have the citizenship requirement. The requirement is simply to have a person witness it.
Is that controversial, Representative Groenberg?
It was, and there was also a move, and I don't remember, Ms. Glazer, correct me if my memory's kind of hazy and I don't see Mr. Narrows, who just walked in here. Thank you, Peter. I had talked about offering an amendment. 39 states have eliminated the requirement of any witnesses. You just have to swear under oath, under penalty of perjury, that you are Liesl McGuire. And 39 states have done away entirely with the witnessing requirement. I thought that was a great idea. Did I ever offer that? What happened with that?
I don't believe that you did. In answer to the chair's question, the amendment passed 5-2. So,
I would be prepared to offer an amendment, a conceptual amendment, if the committee wanted to do away with the witnessing requirement and just make you swear it under penalty of perjury, which is a felony. If you're, you know, if you're giving a false identification, that would be my own view.
Representative Coghill?
You may bring up an interesting point. For example, if you have a witness under oath that is a non-citizen, are they more liable than the person who would be making the perjured statement?
No, because the witness doesn't swear under oath. The witness just witnesses it.
Okay.
And my recollection through the chair, don't you, when you vote, aren't you already under penalty of perjury that you're identifying yourself? I don't even.
What does the form say, Laura, Ms. Glazer, on the witnessing part?
Chair. It's important in law to know that the witness is supposed to be, seeking a witness is your last course. What it says on the envelope that's returned to the division and is reviewed by the absentee review board says, by law your ballot cannot be counted unless you include your signature, have it witnessed, and provide an identifier. And that's in bold. I declare that I am a U.S. citizen of the United States and that I have been a resident of Alaska for at least 30 days. I have not requested a ballot from any other state and am not voting in any other manner in this election. If I had this certification attested by witnesses other than an authorized official, it was because no official empowered to administer an oath was reasonably available. I certify that the foregoing is true and accurate, and that oath is the.
Can we pass that around?
Madam Chair?
Representative Groenberg.
Okay. If the members would look at page 10 and 11 of the bill. If you're voting by fax, that's section 14. In section 16 is voting by mail. Section 14 already requires on line 27 that it be under oath. So if you're voting by fax today, you have to do it under oath. On in looking at section 16, voting by mail, it says that you must mark the ballot in secret, etc., but and it must be in the presence of somebody who can take an oath, but it doesn't say that you must state under oath that you are who you say you are. That's not specifically there in the statute. I think it frankly ought to be, particularly if you do it by fax.
We're
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, all I will say is the full statute isn't before you either. Agreeing to look at the full.
Vanessa's making copies.
Okay, sorry. Sorry, Ms. Glazer.
Is there something else in the form that says you do?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. No, all I was saying was you're only looking at the part of the statute that's being amended. I'm looking now at the full statute to see if, in fact, we do require an oath that the voter is who they say they are.
Under oath.
Ms. Glazer, in what cases, give us an example of what a case, if there was one, or an example of how you would use the witness, the witnesses that are listed. Has the Division of Election ever had an occasion to contact any of the witnesses on any of these ballots for suspected voter fraud, or, I mean, what's the reality of how?
Madam Chair, as you know, this was my first full election cycle with the division, and I know in several instances I was asked to make a call when the witness signature was the voters. So then that's not, you know, you haven't met the requirements of law. Where the signature was the same as the voters but had the same name, and a different name but same signature, you know, we have an Attorney General's opinion that says, you know, we're not signature experts, but then when it's flagrant, you know, we make that call. In the case of a close election or a concern, or as people are observing the absentee review boards, if there are questions, you know, that are raised, then we do go further with that. But to be honest, we don't know that every single witness is who they say they are.
But it's a tool that the division has if there was ever a question about it. I agree with Representative Gruenberg that you might want to have something there about your, you know, an oath requirement, but I would be reluctant to remove the witnessing part of it, but maybe even add that those witnesses take an oath when they witness it, under penalty of perjury or something like that, because I think it's a really important provision. You know, it's a very, very serious thing, and some of these elections are very close, and frankly, there are a whole lot of people out there that, in the world, sadly, that just don't care and will sign whatever, and so be it. And so if it's not somebody who's a notary and who hasn't sworn to uphold all of those things, you've got to, I think, have some kind of a mechanism for it, and it may even serve as a deterrent. I'm not sure, but you know, sometimes these things, just the mere thought that you would have to ask somebody to verify who you were if it really weren't you, might serve as a deterrent. You might be less likely to simply say that it's you, knowing that you'd have to ask somebody. I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just say that, you know, the first bar is the highest, which is, you know, that the voter in the presence of a notary public commissioned officer of the armed forces, including the National Guard, district judge or magistrate, U.S. postal official, registration official, or other person qualified to administer an oath, you know, that should be the first test. Now, we, of course, don't scrutinize the fact that you've chosen two witnesses when, in fact, there's probably a notary public working in your office. I mean, we do the most, our state is recognized for doing the most to make sure a ballot is counted. So, we don't judge you on whether you've really met the highest bar and taken the easier route. But it is, you know, they are important.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No, thanks.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg?
This is an unusual statute because the only relevant part of it you have on page 11. The rest of that statute isn't particularly relevant to what we're talking about. And this form that we've been given actually tracks the statute. So, as you can see, it more than tracks the statute, because this way this thing is drafted now, it doesn't require that it be under oath even in front of a notary. The form does, but it seems to me if we're going to require an oath, we should require the oath whether or not it's in front of the notary. And then what they would do would be would have you say here up at the top, signed under penalty of perjury. And I think that that's frankly a good idea. And if you want, I'll make that conceptual amendment now. We could call that amendment number one. Okay. That we amend AS 15.20.081 to require that that here, just like with facts, that it be signed under penalty of perjury or under oath.
And just for the record, the State Affairs version is properly before us, but it's version I, just for the record. So that's what we're amending. So that's conceptual amendment number one. Is there an objection to the amendment? Okay, hearing none, that amendment carries.
Let me ask if I may.
Continue on just briefly on that same line of thinking. Do you think that people who witness in option two ought to be doing that?
I think that if you have the voter and you have the signature and the identifier, you absolutely know who that voter is. There's no question who he's supposed to be. If you have a voter fraud, well, you know who they're claiming to be. You may not know who actually signed it.
Right.
But if you're going to have one witness or two witnesses and you have gangs who steal elections roaming the countryside as brigands and thieves, they're stealing votes, they're going to do it anyway.
Murdering dead people.
Yeah. And 39 states don't require this. We have a very clean system of elections. I know a lot of people win by a very small number of votes around here all the time. I feel much better that it's under oath. And I've got to say, I don't think I even offered this amendment because I like the idea, but I was offering, I probably had 25 amendments in this thing.
And you're the blue tabs, Representative.
Oh, God. So I would certainly vote for this, but if anybody in the committee doesn't feel totally comfortable, I won't offer it.
Yeah, I don't.
Then let's not.
But and the reason is because of what you just said, that you know, signing, making a signature and putting an identifier. I mean, geez, we just got done with House Bill 131 and identity theft. Mm-hmm. How easy it is to obtain somebody's, you know, date of birth, their driver's license, their Social Security number, and as Ms. Glazier said, I mean, I think you're already giving somebody a real out, because what you want them to do is do it with a notary public. And then people get busy, and or they don't know someone's around or whatever, or they're in a rural community where they don't have easy access. So you're already giving an out. And I just think you really do want two individuals. And like I said, I think it's the deterrent factor. I think it's the red face test and some kind of recourse for the division if there was ever truly a terrible allegation to go back and try to interview at least these people and say, who was this that you were? You know, we take it for granted, and I know you know this, but there are some states that still have terrible, terrible problems where names of really, frankly, sorry, but recently passed away folks whose whole identities have not yet been expunged are voting. You know, and it is unbelievable to me, as you said, that there are these people that would have that much energy to go and do that, but they do. So, Representative Coghill?
Well, yes and no. When I go in to vote, I go in and show a piece of ID, and you have people who are looking and checking my signature against my ID, and they're under oath. So when I go in to vote, I have a very high bar to go over. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have a very clean system. Where our system starts getting messier is in the distance mail department. And knowing that dishonest people will be dishonest, I think the affirmation of oath on the signature of the individual is probably the last place you'll go. But if honest people are going to vote and have either their date or their signature verified by a signature of a witness, I don't find that egregious, that somebody would have somebody looking over their shoulder in an honest way saying that I went out of my way and got somebody to verify either the time that I signed this or the fact that I am who I am. Doesn't bother me at all. Now, can we track that easily? Probably not. But once again, it's the very weeding process that we have under the subsection D that starts off with in the presence of a notary public. The reason we had it in the presence of a notary public is because we're trying to do the same thing we do at the voting booth, and that is identify who they are. And I think there's a continued need to keep the level high. Now, just because people can get around it doesn't mean I think we should drop it. So, and in our day where we're going to be doing more and more high-tech talk along our voting system, I'm not willing to drop these requirements just yet, because there probably are ways that we'll be able to do verification much more simply, probably in the not too far future. But at this point, I think let's let honest people be honest, and we'll just have to work at the rest. And as a man who's done a lot of registration, I can tell you that it makes it good to have somebody looking over your shoulder, because what they do is they double check what you're doing on that form. Generally speaking, I think self-government being what it is, that people are willing to take the responsibility and say, this is serious business. And if we take that seriousness to a lesser degree, then it's shame on us if we don't get that seriousness accompanying the rest of our activities. So I just that's why I say yes and no. I agree that maybe it's not that valuable for those who would do wrong, but I think it's valuable for those who do right.
Very good points.
Madam Chair, if it might help the committee to know, I'll ask us to know that we are going out to bid on a new voter registration system. Our old 20 years old system is way past needing a replacement. And the newer systems do allow you to scan in a voter signature and maintain that. So for being able to compare, when the absentee review board is looking on the screen and right now entering in the identifiers and checking the name, they will also be able to visibly see the signature. So that first alert for fraud or gathering other signatures, coupled with the fact that you'd be taking an oath under perjury that you are who you say you are, I think does help strengthen the system.
Ms. Glaser, this is amazing that I really don't know this, but I've had so many kind of different opinions offered to me through the years. You know, I do something that I wonder, because I believe in the people in my district and I believe that they are honest and I want them to get out and vote. When I'm out going door to door, I will bring along with me absentee ballot request forms, and I will encourage people that if they think they're going to get into a bind with respect to work and things like that, or picking their kids up, you know, people with very busy schedules, that they ought to go ahead and just request one of these and vote. And then a while back, somebody told me that there was a part of the law that said you're really only supposed to do that if it was, you know, some type of an unforeseeable hardship, or you're out of the state or something like that. What can you point me to the section that governs that, and what is the rule on that?
Madam Chair, other states you have to swear that you are ill, incapacitated, or will be traveling. While we may make suggestions in the law that, you know, again, like I was there when Representative Martin had the bifax, it was supposed to be an addendum, not the first way you choose to vote, but an extra option to open up the process. The same for our by-mail. But we don't have that test here. We don't question a voter on their intent. Are you really here, but you'd prefer to vote by mail? Is this more convenient? So what you're explaining is not wrong, to encourage somebody, you know, if you think you're going to be absent, to go ahead and apply, that the person then isn't absent, we don't know, we don't test.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in statute that requires that.
Any further questions? We do have one. Actually, we have two other people to testify. Representative Kira.
I was under the impression that this bill was largely technical in nature. There are some very substantive provisions regarding the initiative process, and I've got about seven or eight yellow tabs all of a sudden.
We're going to hold the bill, so that'll give you time to, that's no problem. I know Representative Dahlstrom has to go. I want to at least get to the testimony, and even if it's just me sitting here, of these two individuals that have waited to testify, and we'll have the company of Ms. Glazier. She knows it's a very heavy bill, and I think she spent 2 weeks in state affairs. We're hoping they can cut 2 months? Okay. we're going to try to cut that down for her, because she does have other work she does, by the way, besides just legislation. And just May 10th is right around the corner. We're leaving town. So we'll have her come back, but that'll give you some time, Representative Garrett, and I know others. I've received suggestions for different amendments and things like that, so that'll give us time to look over the things that are in there and have the debate. So the next person I have is Joe Sonneman. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Sonneman.
Very welcome. Thank you very much. My name's Joe Sonneman. I'm at live at 324 Willoughby here in Juneau, and I've been an Alaskan since 71. I also have earned a PhD in government and also went to law school, and the combination of those things taught me some things about elections, and I'd just like to talk about two sections of the bill and about two amendments. So first I'd like to talk about Section 10, which is the ballot rotation section, and people didn't always know about statistics, but when they started to discover the science of statistics, after a while the statisticians figured out that if there was a long list of candidates, people at the top of the list seemed to do somewhat better. Usually the guesstimate was about 5 to 7% better.
Wow.
And Woodrow Wilson, the only political scientist to become president, even wrote an article about that back about 1910 or so. And then, of course, when candidates learned this, some candidates actually began changing their names because candidates were listed alphabetically in those days. So to prevent the gaming of the system, you might say, a number of states and territories even began rotating the name of candidates on separate ballots, so you would have as many ballots, versions of the ballot, as there were candidates, and as a voter came in, they would get one, the first voter would get a ballot from pile A and the second one from pile B and so on, and Alaska was one of those places that had adopted full ballot rotation, and we had that in place for about 70 years. So that's just a brief one-minute history of where things were. And then about 1997, I believe, 96, a new governor and lieutenant governor were elected, and the task force for the lieutenant governor recommended that ballot rotation be done away with as a cost-saving measure. And in my view, unfortunately, that was adopted, and so I filed suit, and it went up to the Supreme Court, which decided 3-2 that the legislature was entitled to pick a fair method, did not have to pick the fairest method. And there's no question that the method that is used today is a fair method, and the method that is used today is that Division of Elections picks the letters of the alphabet, each letter is picked separately. It's not that they pick one letter and then go alphabetically thereafter, but they pick each letter separately.
For each House district, is that correct?
Yes. Thank you. My point, though, is that even though that's a fair method, it's a method in which if there is any positional bias, one person, whoever is picked gets the benefit of all that positional bias for that House district. And so, to me, even though that's a fair method, it's a drawing. It's not an election, because somebody could easily be the winner because of the result of the drawing rather than as a result of the voting. Nevertheless, that's what we've had for about 8 years, I guess. And as Representative Grunberg said, the committee, the State Affairs, I guess, last year, went in favor of full ballot rotation. There is, of course, with full ballot rotation, there's a substantial cost, a cost that Alaska was able to afford for 70 years when we did not have oil money, and it's curious to me that now we say we can't afford it. But that to one side, I think the method that is before you in Section 10 of this bill is a very creative way to improve on the present system without incurring the costs of full ballot rotation. Obviously, it's not quite as good as full ballot rotation, but the cost is much, much less. So I hope I kept that part to about 2 minutes. So I would say that I favor Section 10. And then,
Madam Chair, just for your information, Representative Seaton, the Chair of State Affairs, asked me to do a diagram here, and that's what I've given you out. I discussed that earlier. Joe, here's a copy for you if you'd like.
Okay. And what Section 10 does is, rather than rotating by ballot, it rotates by House district. So because it rotates by House district, the House representatives, those candidates don't rotate.
Right.
And the Senate candidates, you know, there's one rotation for state Senate candidates, and then for statewide offices, there's 40 rotations available. U.S. House, Governor.
So the theory is people are sort of in a rush and they don't really care, and so they just check the first name they see?
This was more prevalent, I believe, in, for example, if you had, I think New York State used to elect its judges, and you might have a list of 200 names,
sure,
and you didn't know any of them, and so, you know, people would just, well, I'll vote for whoever's on top, and there was to a lesser degree, some people would vote for the last name on the list, and there's a counter argument. Some more recent studies say that this positional bias doesn't really matter so much when you have very few candidates, or when there's a lot of advertising and people know them very well, or there's strong party identification. Well, and we could argue about, you know, but I mean, there were 7 candidates for the U.S. Senate in this last race, so.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to give background on both sides. There are, but the early studies were based on long lists of candidates, and they did find positional bias there. So I support this as something that hopefully can win approval in this budget-conscious age, even though we were able to afford full rotation and when we had much less money. I don't understand that part, but that's neither here nor there. If I can go on to Section 19, that was just the part that Representative Garra had asked about let's see here. Making sure that a vote tally system does have a paper trail. I should say that among the other things, besides taking that case to the Supreme Court, I also chaired the recent recount committee this last fall. I'm speaking on my own behalf, though, not representing any person or
the senatorial recount?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And so that was the point about having the paper trail was something that folks in Alaskans for Fair Elections were concerned about, and we're very glad that Representative Grunberg added the amendment to just make it explicit that there should be a paper trail. I mean, that is the law, thanks to the previous legislature, I just want to say we hope that remains there. Now, I did want to talk about 2 amendments that I understand are coming up before you, and because you usually go into discussion of amendments after you have public testimony, this is my only chance to bring it up, if I may. The first is a conceptual amendment by Representative Gara, and especially it's section 14 about review of ballot counting, adding the words on lines 14 to 16 about a hand count of ballots from one randomly selected precinct that accounts for at least 5% of the ballots. This is an amendment which was offered in State Affairs, and I know a number of the folks in Alaskans for Fair Elections are very favorable to this, and the reason is because we are now in a computerized age where we have optical scanning machines and possibly soon to have direct response. We just press a button and there's no longer there's a paper trail, but the state of Alaska has all of its elections now are programmed by one civil servant programmer who I'm sure is an absolutely wonderful person, but it's just one person. And it's like if you were running a bank and you only had one cashier, wouldn't you want to audit that cashier? Well, the hand count is essentially like an audit, just to make sure that say that nobody has made an offer you can't refuse to the one programmer, or that somebody has somehow gotten remote access to any of the machines and changed the programming. The feeling, if I may talk about another committee, the feeling in State Affairs as I saw it was that well, why fix a problem we don't have yet? And to me that was I think it's sort of like saying that there's a road and people are crossing the road, and in a day of horses and carriages, maybe you didn't need a stop sign to protect pedestrians. But now we're in a more modern age. Cars are coming along and the road is much more dangerous to cross, and we really need a stop sign. And it was, to me, it was as if the previous comment was, well, nobody's been killed there yet. Well, it's even worse because if an election is somehow stolen through programming or something, misprogramming, we non-programmers won't even know it. We won't know that anybody's been killed, to mix my metaphors madly. We won't know that the election's been wrongly decided because we're not the programmers, and there's nobody auditing our one programmer in the whole state.
What was the reason this failed, this amendment? Cost?
I believe Representative Grunberg was on the committee, and I hesitate.
Grunberg, what was the reason?
Party line vote. And I don't recall a discussion, if any. That's not true. I think that the feeling was that there was a fiscal note connected with this, was there not?
3.5 thousand.
Yeah. So it was a small fiscal note, not much. And it was unfortunate that, in my opinion, it failed.
Okay.
So I just wanted to say that both I and I'm sure a number of folks with Alaskans for Fair Elections support this conceptual amendment, which is offered here by Representative Gara. And then I'd like to turn, if I may, to the amendment labeled G12 on the upper right. And this has to do with raising, this amendment would substantially raise the amount of deposits that folks requesting recounts would have to come up with in order to get a recount started. Under current law, a candidate or a group of 10 citizens may request a recount, but they have to put up a deposit. Currently, the law says deposit needs to be $10,000 for a statewide recount. And the current law also says that if the cost of the recount is less than the deposit, the director refunds the amount by which it's less, but if the law is silent as to what if the cost of the recount is more. And it's been reported in the newspapers and I think prior testimony that even though our group came up with the $10,000, that the cost of the recount was more on the order of $30,000 or $40,000. And so this amendment, I think, is trying to say that it's something like a user fee and the folks who request a recount should pay the cost of what they get, that they get the recount and therefore they should pay for it. And on the surface, that sounds pretty good, but we'd like to explain why it isn't. As I said earlier, a recount provides an audit function, okay? And so just as audits are a cost of doing business, we think recounts are a cost of doing government, if you like. The potential of a recount keeps elections honest. And consequently, if you raise the deposit requirement, and here it's not, these are not minor increases. This would go from $750 for a House district recount would go to $10,000, approximately 12 times as much. And statewide would go to $50,000, 5 times as much. If you let the world know through law that recounts are going to be much, much more expensive, and the last sentence of the amendment says there's no limit because if the cost of the recount exceeds the amount of the deposit, the applicant must pay the remainder. If you let the world know that recounts are going to be much more expensive, that's equivalent to letting the world know that election audits are going to occur much more rarely. And so those people who are unfortunately inclined to try and sway elections in improper ways are going to say Alaska is a target, and we will be able to do whatever we can do in Alaska, and the odds of somebody coming up with $50,000 for a statewide recount are that much less than $10,000.
And are you allowed to pay for recounts out of campaign funds? Out of what are the sources? What are the options that you have to pay for?
Ask the director on that. I don't know the answer.
You are.
The way Alaskans for Fair Elections worked was we set up a website and we got donations from people at large. Most of the donations were small. $100 was a high contribution. And the other part about recounts is we are only allowed 5 days, and including weekends, to raise that money. And the actual experience that we had was we raised $9,600 in 5 days, and one of our own members chipped in the final $400. So it was, technically speaking, we did not quite make the $10,000, and for us to have attempted to make $50,000 would have been impossible. So this would be a severe burden, let's put it that way. It would make it impossible. I'd also like to say that recount deposit fees are not really user fees, because it's not just the people requesting the recount that benefit from the accurate counting of an election. We believe everybody benefits when an election is accurately counted, and therefore we think it's inappropriate to single out the requesting group to pay the whole burden. Neither do we believe that a recount deposit should be a penalty. For example, in international environmental law, there's a principle of the polluter pays. Well, we don't think a recount request is like pollution. We think everybody benefits instead of with pollution, everybody suffers. So again, we don't think it's appropriate to penalize the folks who request it, nor are the current version of the law, I believe, would have the department or the state, rather, pays when it's less than 0.5% difference, but more than 0.5%, the requester must pay. Well, that's a very narrow margin to say if you're at 0.49% difference, the state pays, but if you're at 0.51, you've got to come up with $50,000. It seems an extreme difference. And we had, earlier in the previous committee, we had suggested looking at the state of Maine, which had a graduated approach. I think the committee felt that that was too complex. We think the appropriate course then for this committee is to do as State Affairs did, and that's to defeat this amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Representative Seaton and I really took, I think, more time with the bill than anybody else. And we looked a lot at the Maine model. Dr. Sonneman gave us a copy of that. And that has a graduating. If, you know, if it narrows a certain amount, then you pay less. Very complicated in a little state like Alaska. I felt it was, and he agreed that it was just better to deal with this. And we first divided the question and knocked off the last part, and then we voted the whole thing in committee.
Several members of Alaskans for Fair Elections commented on the main concept, and they said, really, it brings us back to the Representative Gara's amendment. They said, in the computerized age, you can make the results come out however you want, so that you could defeat even a graduated system if you had access to, if you were somehow able to misprogram the computers. So it's important, we think, therefore, to have, it's sort of doubly important to have the control of an automatic count of 5%. It's the computerized age that drives us to all this. I noticed also that Dr. Don Anderson had sent in some written testimony in support of Representative Gara's and Alaskans for Fair Elections. I'm sure they, and certainly I, agree with those comments. I did want to also call to your attention, that concludes my comments on specifics. I'll just say very briefly in closing that in the experience of working with the Department, Division of Elections on in this recent recount, we certainly appreciate the efforts of the division. They did some things that perhaps were not necessary. They agreed to our request that to hand count 10% of the precincts and to take those 10% from only the precincts that had been machine counted on election night. So we do appreciate that. We also learned a lot about election procedures. And so, for example, just call to your attention that because there is no federal centralized database, when people vote absentee from another in an Alaskan election, they send it in from another state, there is now no control on making sure they don't also vote in the other state. Perhaps that could be addressed by bilateral agreements with the states where we get the most voters from. But also, even in absentee voting in Alaska, if somebody votes absentee in advance and they go into their own voting place on election day, they may be able to vote there also unless the list of registered voters is updated. And we were finding that it was not updated rapidly enough. So those people would get caught in 6 months because there's a voter history file, and that voter history file would catch the fact that they voted twice. But in the meantime, the votes would have counted. That concludes my remarks. Basically, I'm in favor of 10 and 19. I'm in favor of Representative Gara's amendment, and I hope you will do as the prior committee did and not allow the amendment raising deposit fees to go forward.
Thank you. And just one final question for you. Seems like you've done a lot of research. Are you aware of any states that do have a system in place to check whether or not voters are voting in their state and other states, either by way of a bilateral agreement or by way of some type of electronic?
I don't know the answer to that offhand.
Ms. Glaser, she's nodding no.
Okay, thank you.
So, thank you, good point. Okay, final person, Mr. Ken Jacobs. Oh, my apologies. There are actually two, and he was ahead of you, Merle Thompson. And then Ken Jacobus. Sorry, Ken. And then we'll adjourn. Sorry, it went so late, guys.
Merle Thompson, Sioux Sitna Valley. I was actually the past chairman of the Ogun recall, so I have some sense of recall parts of this. Also, I was a candidate, independent candidate for the state legislature. I guess Dr. Sonneman saved me a lot of time. So, I mean, a lot of the things he had pointed out are specifically some of the same things I was going to talk about, so I'll spare us all. But Representative Guerra's bill on the audit is pretty pertinent, I think. It's something that's probably only going to improve the system and improve what people think about the system, and which is, I think, very important when it comes to elections. In the last in state affairs, that is, I testified that this is a good bill, and I don't pass out compliments very easily. I guess Mrs. Glazier or Ms. Glazier can tell you that. But after the fact, there was a bunch of amendments added to it, which actually would have made the bill a lot less attractive. And I see one of them has reappeared, and that would be this amendment on the recount deposit going from 10 to 50,000 statewide. And Mr. Sonneman addressed that fairly well, but I come from a House district, and the amount jumps from $750 for a recount to $10,000, which is a huge jump. And I have the unenviable position of not belonging to a party. I'm an independent. So whereas if I were to fail the automatic count by a few votes, it would be literally impossible for me to gather that kind of money in a short amount of time that you're allowed to do that in. Whereas somebody from, like, the majority party, for instance, who are a lot better funded, would probably have no problem meeting that criterion. I was a poli-sci major, and one of the political statistics classes that I had also pointed out a study that was done. This is probably in the 80s, and on being first on the ballot. And amongst people voting on a party line, it didn't make a whole lot of difference. But for the people that didn't actually have an affiliation or didn't vote party line, it made a difference between 3 and 5% on the various studies that they did being first on the ballot. I was actually first.
Were
on the
first?
I was first, but I might have been beaten worse. But other than that, there's an amendment that isn't in here. At least I haven't seen it, and maybe I passed over it because there seems to be a large stack of them. That was defeated in state affairs. That was added after I testified, and I'm looking ahead of that possibility, and that is removing the $1 payment for recalls, initiatives, and referendums. And if that happens to pop up or is in here and I haven't noticed it, I am wholeheartedly against that because of the changes made last year to that process, where we have to go to further areas of the state and get a larger percentage of the votes in those areas, which in essence make that a much harder process. And that $1 is certainly a way of offsetting that for folks that have a job and you know, can't get away and can't afford to travel or buy a plane ticket to Antioch or whatever to collect signatures there. So if that happens to appear, I would hope that would be struck down again like it was in the last committee. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, Ken.
Madam Chair.
Oh, pardon me, Representative.
I'd just like to thank you for all the work you've done in sticking around, and really appreciate it.
Mr. Jacobus.
Thank you. I will be brief. I have 4 points, and I'll cover them quickly. First point is independent presidential candidates. It's good that you put this provision in the bill. It should stay there. It should have been in there a long time ago. It's required by the U.S. Constitution. We're the 50th state to adopt such a provision. You avoided litigation by doing that.
What section is that?
Oh,
just so we have it on the record.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Independent presidential candidates and method of selection. There are several sections which deal with
it. Okay, well, let's go. You don't need to.
Okay.
I think we're clear. Go ahead.
Second point is on positional bias. I think that there definitely is positional bias, and what has been proposed is it doesn't solve the problem entirely because it doesn't solve positional bias with respect to all elections, but it does the best job of solving positional bias without additional cost. And I support that wholeheartedly. Basically, what you get is a fairer election, a more fair election without spending additional dollars on it. So that's a real good idea. Third point. For signing referendum petitions and initiative petitions, you require printing the voter's name, date of birth, address, and the date of birth you're identifying is additional identifier.
Madam Chair, if we could have page and line.
Section 30 is an example. That again appears at several places. It also appears at section 26. But basically the point I'm making is that the date of birth is only one additional identifier that you can use. Historically on petitions we've used date of birth, we've used voter registration number, we've used social security number. Sometimes it's difficult to get the date of birth from people. So if you want an additional identifier, I would suggest that you change the word date of birth to an additional identifier and let the people who circulate the petitions determine what that additional identifier will be depending upon what the signer is willing to give.
What's an example of something that you've received?
Social Security number is an identifier. Voter registration number is an identifier. Day of birth would work as long as you don't have to put the year in. That would be a sufficient identifier, and people would not have to admit as to how old they were.
Okay.
So I'd suggest that change.
Madam Chair, on that point.
Representative Gruenberg?
I saw people from the Division of Elections shaking their heads on some of this. We had quite a discussion on this in state affairs. And I would ask leave of the chair, since Mr. Jacobus is not going to be here physically, if on that point we could take a minute's testimony from them so they can we can see both sides at some point here, whenever you wish.
Come join me here.
Yes. Madam Chair, Laura Glazer, Director of Division of Elections again. I'm looking at a copy of a petition booklet. We request, but we still aren't statutorily, unless this is adopted, allow for a voter to print their name clearly, a residence address, a city, and a voter number or a Social Security number. They're willing to give their full Social Security number right now, and then the signature. What we're asking for is date of birth, but if you were to just allow somebody to pick an identifier, if we don't have that in our system, how can we qualify them? If they decide they're just a hunting and fishing license, that's really nice that the circulator decided that, but then I can't qualify them as a voter, and we need to expand. So our options are, you know, the voter number, Social Security number, or date of birth. We're trying to increase ways to qualify this voter signature, not to make it more difficult, but instead to raise the options.
That's great. We agree with you. As long as we can use voter number, Social Security number, or date of birth, and we actually have used date of birth even on your form, which doesn't authorize it.
What about adding, well, I don't know, but just keeping it consistent with your voter, with your absentee ballot that allows for an Alaska driver's license as well?
Is that on your system?
Madam Chair, that we can check that. We have an agreement right now with Department of Motor Vehicles. And could also
let me know your opinion later. Think about it, but maybe you want to just make it consistent so you have the four options: voter number, Alaska driver's license, date of birth, or your Social Security number.
The thing I was concerned about is the language of the statute specifically requires the date of birth and does not give any other options.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Representative
at
Gruenberg?
The appropriate time, I will offer an amendment conceptually to those, and we'll have it drafted, that it could be any of those four. Would the division be acceptable with that?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, certainly. Again, we were trying to expand the ways that we could qualify signatures and not withdraw. So sometimes when somebody gives us nothing and we have just a signature, it's more difficult to qualify that voter if we had another identifier.
Understood. And your point's well taken with regard to allowing anybody to select what they want. I mean, it could be their library card number or something.
But certainly those as Representative Gruenberg asked, that we could work
I'll have that drafted.
Good.
Our circulators are instructed to use one of the three. If we can use driver's license, that would be great, too.
Fantastic.
The fourth point I wanted to make in my testimony is definition of a political party. And I'd suggest that you consider a whole new approach to it. Right now, and there's been amendments and discussion about it. 2% of the people who voted to the last day election, 3%, 2% of the people are on the voter registration list. What I would suggest is, in the interests of certainty, and other states do this, pick a number. In order to be a qualified political party, you have to have 4,000 registered voters. You have to have 5,000 registered voters, or 2,500. And that would never change depending on the number of people that voted in the election. And that could be reviewed from time to time as the number of voters went up. But the political parties would know exactly what the standards would be that they would have to qualify under. And there are other states. I believe Louisiana does this.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
We discussed this as we worked on this. This is something we could continue to discuss. The issue was that this number would change potentially as the population of the state grew, and it might be more difficult to administer. This is a provision we're looking here generally at section 52 on page 29, and frankly it is always a somewhat controversial hot potato around here. I would hate to have to bring this up every 5-10 years. That would embroil this legislature in a continuing sore point.
Well, as the state grows, if you set it at a number, say 5,000, as the state grows, it's going to become easier for the parties to qualify because there will be a greater population base of them to get their number from.
Through the chair. And that is why there would be efforts to increase it. Otherwise, the effect would be to decrease it proportionately. And I see you're smiling. We used to play Monopoly on the same team.
There you go.
He's a very bright guy. So
I think that third parties should be the right of third parties to get on the ballot, particularly if have the registration of a substantial number of voters, should be made easier, not harder.
That's the policy issue through the chair.
It is. Yeah, okay.
By doing so, set a low threshold with an exact number, but not too low.
And what did we do, maybe Vanessa, you remember, in the U.S. Senate vacancy bill, did we put 3%? Do you remember?
The current law stands, if you look at section 52, you
3%,
can see
right?
it.
Yeah.
It was 3% of the...
This was originally Representative
Seaton's. Gubernatorial, if not Senate, if not Rep.
We tweaked it around again.
Yeah, we had the House companion, and then there was the Senate companion, but it was 3%, and that was to respond to that court decision. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I sure appreciate it. Nice to see you in town.
Thank you.
And thank you, too, Mr. Sonneman. Okay. Thank you. And is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Annette? Okay. Anybody online? Okay. Representative Gruenberg, we'll leave public testimony open.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't know if the division is going to offer anything else that we haven't ever talked about. Okay.
There were some folks that did not get through today on the teleconference line, so I'll leave public testimony open. So if anybody contacts you, you can let them know. We'll bring the bill back up again. I'll be honest with you, Laura, I don't think we're going to bring it up until we get back from Easter, because Wednesday morning we've got to get a couple of other things that have been dragging along out. So we will we'll have it back up again when we get back, and we'll work expeditiously. If members can work on their amendments and things and have them in writing, it'll make it go quicker.
Yeah.
Sure. Representative Garrett.
You'll have that done.
I would like a day where I could just go through the bill and ask questions to Ms. Glazer or somebody else with some expertise, and then have another day after that to do the amendments.
We can do that.
Great.
All right. Thank you very much. And we are adjourned until Wednesday at 8 a.m.